Okay, welcome to another Wednesday webinar. Thanks everybody for joining me. Today is Wednesday, February 11th, 2026. And I hope everybody's having a good week and staying warm if that's relevant to you. It's been really cold here, but starting to get a little bit better. So, as I've been saying, there's still time to sign up for the early enrollment or whatever you call it, early sign-ups for the new biology experience in June at Polyface. So we'll put a link in the chat and maybe in the show notes. So those of you who want to meet people, meet the practitioners, meet the staff and the people who work with and for the new biology clinic. And we're going to have lots of good food and probably some music and some talks and conversations. And it's at the beautiful Polyface Farm. So I hope to see as many people as possible. And like I keep saying, there is still room to sign up. And we're also having, apparently, February is Heart Month. And so we're having our annual Heart Month medicine sale on drtomcowan.com. So you might want to check that out for all the things that we offer that have to do with the heart and circulation. Okay, so let me just maybe pull this up because I'm just going to sort of read from the script of the first item that I had said. And we need to share the sound on this. So this is a letter that hopefully somebody can get to Dr. I think his name is Vernon Coleman. And so this is something that we would like him to see. And I'll just read it. And so hopefully he'll be able to see this. So, dear Dr. Coleman, on behalf of the nominating committee, I would like to congratulate you on your nomination to our award ceremony and banquet. This event, which rivals the Oscars, ESPYs, and the Golden Globe Awards, is an opportunity for you to meet with people of similar renown as yourself. And if you are lucky, you may be chosen as the winner of the award in your category. Our award serves as a reminder of the tragic events occurring these past few years in the Ukraine and is called the Putskis for obvious reasons. The category that you have been nominated in is in the most prestigious award category we offer. That is, and I can almost feel your excitement building, you have been nominated for the Gas Bag of the Year Award, particularly for your valuable and inspiring piece on the awful, quote, no virus crowd. While this award, should you win, itself carries a significant monetary reward, the real prize in this category is you will be custom fitted with a device that allows you to breathe your own, quote, gas even while sitting in a chair. This is particularly valuable for old men who like to sit in chairs. I include a link to a video our committee produced to show the rigorous science behind the brain stimulation effect of breathing one's own gas. We feel this would be particularly valuable in your case. Again, I can't tell you how tickled I am to inform you of your nomination for this incredible prize. All the best, Tom, for the Putski Committee. And again, this was a piece that Dr. Coleman wrote. I think his, I don't know what his site is, something about an old man in a chair on the no virus crowd. And just in case those of you haven't seen this, this is a what I'm referring to as the science behind the smelling your own gas. Instead of stopping to smell the flowers, scientists suggest stopping to smell your farts. While the thought may be enough to make your stomach turn, scientists at Johns Hopkins Medicine say the gas behind the foul, rotten egg smelling stench, known as hydrogen sulfide, protects aging brains from Alzheimer's disease. While the smelly gas is highly toxic in large quantities, smaller doses may provide some serious health benefits. Johns Hopkins researchers noted in a study published in an issue of the Proceedings of the National Academies of Science. So this is the most prestigious scientific journal probably in the United States. And the quote is, "Our new data firmly link aging, neurodegeneration, and cell signaling using hydrogen sulfide and other gaseous molecules within the cell," said the study's lead scientist, Dr. Bindu Pal. "The human body naturally creates small amounts of hydrogen sulfide, which help regulate functions throughout the body. The gases can facilitate cellular messaging within the brain." So, there you go. Research you can use, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. That is why we need the government-funded National Academy of Science to publish important works of scientific discourse like this one. New study indicates sniffing your own fart
increases brain power.
Well,
instead of stopping to smell the flowers, scientists suggest stopping to smell your farts.
Didn't want it to keep going there. Okay, sorry about that. So it's obviously clear that if anybody needs to protect their brain from neurodegeneration, it's obviously you, Dr. Coleman. So I hope you take advantage of this amazing offer. And if you're the lucky recipient, you will be fitted with a custom device that will allow you to avail yourself of this valuable therapy for you, even while sitting in a chair. And then we, of course, have our science news of the week. And I found a number of articles that I thought were worth sharing. So let me see if I can get these. And we don't need to share the sound. So share here. The first one was, we now have a miraculous anti-aging vaccine. Why aren't people getting it? Research found that a routine vaccine slows aging and cuts dementia risk. So for those of you who didn't know this, the shingles vaccine given for the imaginary chickenpox virus stops people from getting Alzheimer's and dementia and stops them from aging. So if you believe that, you'll believe just about anything. Go out and get your shingles vaccine if you don't want to end up as getting dementia. So that's the first science news. The second one Okay, scientists discovered evolution went into overdrive right after the death of the dinosaurs. So the story is a catastrophic impact of an asteroid 66 million years ago brought death and devastation on Earth, but also fascinating new life. Now, mind you, this was not 65 million years ago or 67 years ago, but exactly 66 million years ago. And since this was last week, it was 66 million and 1 week ago. And it turns out I don't have that listed here, but the asteroid was 12.6 miles, so that's three sixes. And the crater was, I think, 6 miles long. And obviously, this is also in the category of if you believe this, you'll believe just about anything. So that was the second science news of the week. And the third one, for those of you who put great hope into the new administration that they were going to do things different, this is from a piece by Dr. Bought a Chair. And it's says Maha is a dumb joke. Dr. Bought a Chair, sell out the cure. He is say he has a report. I guess this doesn't say in here, but he says that we actually have a cure for sickle cell anemia. It was NIH funded research that did this, but the problem is it costs $3 million. So Dr. Bhattacharya is going to do something about that and make it cheaper. So everybody with sickle cell anemia or everybody will who is possibly going to get sickle cell anemia will be able to avail themselves of this miraculous therapy at a reasonable price. Now, I don't know if you want to guess what the therapy is, but if you don't want to guess, I'll tell you. Of course, it is a mRNA vaccine. Exactly what you all voted for, I'm sure, when you voted for a new direction in Maha and the Health and Human Service for more access to mRNA vaccines. Interestingly, for me, I got first thought about sickle cell anemia back in medical school when I was doing a pediatric resident doing pediatrics in medical school. I could probably stop the share for a minute. And it was one of the first examples where I started questioning the whole disease model, even though it was very unformed in my mind what I was looking at. But so we're told, again, that the process that we're doing here is we find the claim and we investigate the validity or the truth of the claim. So the claim is that people with this disease called sickle cell anemia are born with an abnormal form of hemoglobin, which causes an abnormal deformity, you could say, of their red blood cells, which then essentially accumulate in the joints and in the other tissues, and then give them symptoms and lead to a shorter and more difficult life. The important point to note is because this is a genetic condition, they are born with it and they have it from day one. So, in other words, they have this abnormal hemoglobin from day one and they have this abnormally shaped red blood cell from day one, and there is no chance of this coming and going. It's just this is what you've got. So, the first person, and I think actually the only person I ever saw in medical school or residency with sickle cell anemia, I still remember it was probably an 18, 17-year-old African American guy. And it's typically found in African American people. And he had a sick his first sickle cell crisis when he was 18. And that meant he had joint pains and abdominal pains, and I think vomiting and other gastrointestinal symptoms. And I was the one who admitted him into the hospital. And so I took his history and I asked him all kinds of questions. And as far as he said, he had no health problems before this episode of sickle cell crisis. He had the usual vaccines and the usual crappy food and all the rest of it, but nothing in particular happened that he knew of to precipitate this event. So then when I presented him to the attending pediatrician, and said this is his first episode. And for some reason, I asked him, how come if he had a genetic condition, which presumably was there from day one, he had the same hemoglobin and the same formation of red blood cells since literally the day he was born? How come he went 17, 18 years of being totally normal, and then all of a sudden he gets this huge crisis event when he's 18? And I still remember the pediatrician looked at me and he said, well, the disease was unmasked. And I remember thinking, although I had the good sense not to say it at the time, well, he should have put his mask back on. Of course, I didn't say that, which is actually a ridiculous answer, obviously. So it couldn't possibly have been the same thing that he had all 18 years. Why then wouldn't he have the same symptoms all the time? Something happened to him. Now, he didn't know what happened, and I didn't know how to ask. And I don't know whether he took some medicine or had acne medicine or had a vaccine or I don't know what happened. But something happened. And then looking further into it, it turns out that my best guess on sickle cell, the whole thing has nothing to do with genetics. It's basically a staining artifact. So because of the way they stain the red blood cells, they look different in these people, and then they have certain toxic condition which makes a deformity of the red blood cells, depending on whether they're exposed to vaccines or chemical poisons, which is probably why it happens more in Africa. It has nothing to do with preventing them from getting malaria, like we were told. It's just a staining artifact brought on by probably certain particular chemicals and nonspecific poisoning of the person that causes a deformity of their cells, and then they don't act right, and then they get all the symptoms. This can't possibly be a you were born with it. Then, if you were born with it, how come you didn't have it when you were 3 and 5 and 8? How come it comes and goes if you were always born with it? And it's this, it's re only just a function of the red blood cells or the hemoglobin that you have an abnormal gene causing this. That cannot possibly be the answer. And so, at the end of the day, I think Dr. Bhattacharya should stick to furniture procurement, which you would think that if the NIH has a budget of like $50 billion, they would have already bought enough chairs by this point to have enough. And so maybe he can finish buying the chairs and then he can retire. And the final sharing, which is not really science news, but I happened to see this just an hour ago. This was on a AP article that I saw that Americans are losing hope for the future. And so there was an article that 59% of Americans think things are going to get worse, etc. I'm sure you've all heard about that. And in one of the comments, I happened to see this, so I'll read it. Millions have beat obesity with GLP-1s, cancer therapies being discovered at a record pace. AI is making most people's jobs easier. Renewable energy is being added at a record pace. Millions more have access to the internet. Autonomous vehicles are going to make roads safer. More vaccines have come out. Gene editing therapy is working in previously incurable disease. The ozone is healing. Breathe, which he spelled wrong, people. And I only show this to see to make sure everybody knows who we're dealing with as our fellow citizens. And maybe the AP story is right. We have a long way to go, because if you can write something like this, and I'm sure this kind of stuff is shared by millions and millions and millions of Americans, you just get the real sense of, man, we got a long way to go here. Okay, so that's the science news and the nominations for the Pootski Awards. If somebody knows Dr. Coleman and wants to send him this, I'd be happy to. And maybe if he's lucky enough, he can win the annual Pootsie Award. There's been a lot of prestigious winners and nominees in the past. And like I said, this rivals the Academy Awards and the Oscars and the Etsys and ESPYs, etc. So he should be really proud of that. Over his life, he has been able to come up with a piece like he did on the No Virus crowd. All right. Enough of that. So I have some questions here. Let's see if I can get through them. I have seven. Some of these I probably won't be able to say much. The first one is, are chemtrails real? And if so, how should we go about detoxifying from chemtrails? So I just want to say, first of all, that I am no expert on chemtrails, even though I've probably read maybe 10 or 20 different articles and been in a few talks and seen other discussions and been part of chat groups and all kinds of things where people are talking about it. I think all I can say for sure is that we never saw anything like this when I was growing up. This is a phenomena that's somewhat recent, although I can't tell you how long it's been, and it may have been going for a long time. They just changed it. And it certainly seems to be something that's new and has something that's acknowledged by the government, something that they actually write reports about and actually tell you what's in it to a certain extent. So I think there is something about this weather modification, and it's not a good thing. It's not a good thing at all. Although I can't say to the extent or that I really know what's in it or I know any of the details. And so I think there's many more people who are more up on this. The only thing I would say is I'm cautious about this because this is one of those areas that can easily lapse into sort of fear porn paralysis. And while I'm not saying it's not real and there isn't something, they're not people trying to modify the weather and put chemical crap in the air and that this is harmful and it's poisoning all the life on Earth, etc. I think there's probably a lot of truth in that. I think that if you don't have symptoms, that you should just basically carry on with the usual things that we're doing, which means eating good food and trying to breathe as clean air as you can and being out in the sun. This wouldn't stop me, doesn't stop me from going outside, having my bare feet on the ground, growing my own plants, raising my own animals, eating my own food, eating the food from my neighbors, and doing all the things that I otherwise would do. And personally, I don't spend a lot of time worrying about that these people are going to be killing me, even though I'm not a fan of who's ever behind this, or I don't see giving them a lot of attention. And if there's any way to stop it, I'd be happy to support that. But at this point, I don't really see that besides just continuing on our quest to eliminate the government as much as possible and as ultimately as completely as possible, which I think is what a lot of us are trying to do in our own way. More than that, I'm going to have to defer to people who've studied this more intensively as far as specific detoxification protocols. But again, I would only use that if you, and this goes for just about anything. If you're doing well, there's a lot to be said for sticking with the basics and having a sort of positive, I can do this, the world will still support me kind of attitude. And I don't mean to be Pollyannish about it. I'm not saying there isn't the most nefarious kind of agendas out there, but I don't think we can spend our lives being afraid and cowering in our rooms because of something like this. Okay, I'm sure that answer won't satisfy everybody, but again, you're going to have to look to somebody else to get a more definitive answer. The second question was something that I'd never th thought of really, maybe a little bit, and it's interesting. And again, I probably don't have an answer, but the question is it okay to blend foods? And it's interesting because obviously, when you blend foods, you create this vortex in the blender. And I actually do blend foods. I make fruit kefir raw milk smoothies. So, in other words, something that I eat pretty much every day now because I grow a lot of berries. I grow currants and gooseberries and aronia berries. And strawberries and raspberries and blueberries and grapes. And I freeze them and dry them. And then I have local farmers who produce, they don't produce it, but they farm raw milk with no antibiotics, no GMO stuff, no completely 100% grass-fed, no vaccines, none of that stuff. So there's some of it's goats and some of it's goat milk and some of it's cow's milk. And I get the fattiest goat and cow milk I can. And I put some kefir milk starter in it. And then I ferment that for a day. Then I put it in the refrigerator. And then I mix that in a blender with a whole thing of raw milk kefir and a bunch of different frozen berries. And then I put some fermented raw honey that I get from the Really Raw Honey Company. And then I put a squirt of cardamom extract from Burlap and Barrel. And then I often put some of our beet powder in there. And then I put some cinnamon that I get from Burlap and Barrel. And sometimes I put some other of our powders in there, and I whirl that up, and then I either drink it or I mix that with our soaked granola. I put it in the night before or the morning, and then I have that as my dessert after dinner. So I do that pretty much every day. That's my the way that I use berries. And it does create this vortex, and that probably does change the electromagnetic field of the food. And it's interesting to think about whether that harms the food in any way. And so I haven't really thought about that much, except I'm not sort of ruling that out. And, you know, one of the ways I can answer that is, one thing that I became very interested in 45 years ago was the Gerson therapy, and it's because I had actually a doctor friend of that I guy knew who had pretty much fourth stage or metastatic testicular cancer, and he cured himself by doing the Gerson diet. And the Gerson diet was the original carrot juice, apple juice, raw liver juice, interestingly enough, and Gerson said without the raw liver juice it wouldn't work. And otherwise, a vegan diet and no fat. And so, I'm not necessarily saying or endorsing that as the cancer medicine that I would recommend now, but I did see that work. And the reason I'm saying that is as a result of that, I thought that I would probably have some of my patients do the Gerson therapy. And the reason I'm saying that is because Gerson actually was adamant that in order to do this therapy properly and in order for it to work, you had to have the right juicer. And I believe he actually worked with a company called the Norwalk Company. I believe that's their name. And he came up with the juicer that would work. And he said these, I guess you call them centrifugal juicers that spin the food around. He said that changed something about the dynamics of the food. And I would say nowadays we would say it changes the character of the gel, the water in the food. and made it so it wasn't right and didn't have the therapeutic potential. A Norwalk juicer is a two-part juicer, so it has a spinning blade, and you put the food, the carrots, into a tube, and it goes through the spinning blade, and it comes out like a pulp, like a juicy pulp. And then you put that in a press, and it presses the pulp against the top, and the juice comes squeezing out of the bag. So it's very pure juice, and it's very quick, so and there's no spinning it around. It's just one time into a pulp and then squeezing it against the top. And I've said this before, my present from my parents, and I think I'm the only doctor who can say this, graduating from medical school, I convinced them to buy me a Norwalk juicer, which are a couple $1,000 then. I don't know how much they are now. And I actually did that so I could loan it out to patients, and I did that, and I still have it and still occasionally use the juicer. It makes also great potato pancakes if you're ever interested in that. And so I've spent a lot of years being very careful about how I process carrots, beets, celery, apples, liver, etc., into juice, and wouldn't do it in a blender, even though you can juice things in like a Vitamix. I never wanted to do that because I would change the character of the food. And so I never thought about whether with a smoothie, which is much quicker, whether you're actually changing the character of the food. And it's possible. I don't know that. I'm not sure how I would know that. And I don't know that you could make this smoothie in a Norwalk juicer, and it would probably make a mess. But anyways, it's a good question, and I don't really know the answer. But it's something to think about, and I probably will still make it in a Norwalk in my Vitamix blender, but I'll try to do it as quick as I can so I don't disturb the energy dynamics of the food as much as possible, because that is an issue. Okay, next question. Why do people get kidney stones, and what can you do to prevent them? So this is one of those things where the new biology approach and what I've been trying to work on my last half of my career is I keep asking the question. It's like the dumbest kidney is smarter than the smartest nephrologist. And all these things we call diseases are healing strategies of the body. And so some of them seem certainly unpleasant, and maybe even harmful, and maybe even potentially kill you. So why would the body do that? So we're told with kidney stones that, well, it's a combination of dehydration, you're not drinking enough water or don't have enough fluid, and maybe too many things are precipitating either protein metabolites or mineral metabolites. And certainly that's possible. So a combination of not having enough fluids going through the kidneys and maybe having too much calcium, like if you're taking calcium supplements and taking vitamin D supplements. And I know with goats, if they feed them too much protein, they seem to get kidney stones. So they're essentially not able to process the protein and keep it in a water-soluble form that the kidneys could excrete it. So that's certainly a possibility, in which case you certainly don't want to take single mineral supplements, which is different than the seawater and quinton and the plasma seawater that we carry. It's certainly different than the minerals that are found naturally in plants. That's the earth element. And it's also certainly different than using the best salt. I don't think there's any evidence that any of those cause kidney stones. But certainly taking high dose calcium supplements or high dose of any single mineral is not something that I would ever do. But I think another way to look at this is if you're actually deficient in minerals, which I think is more likely the case with most people, your body might store a mineral reservoir somewhere, and this would obviously be in the form of a stone, so that you could use this, have access to excess minerals when you need them, especially in emergency situations. So, in a way, it might be a response to a mineral deficient diet. And so your body then stores minerals in the form of stones, and those create the problem that we call kidney stones. And so, in that case, the solution is, as well as good hydration, that means to have access to an adequate amount of minerals, which means eating the best quality and a liberal amount of seawater and sea plasma and quinton. And that's the strategy that I use. And I think, and not eating sort of toxic food. I think any toxic food or any toxic drugs, I think a lot of this has to do with NSAID use, which actually damages the kidney tubules, and other pharmaceuticals and vaccines and injecting aluminum. And you don't want to inject poisons, which are water soluble, that have to go through the kidneys. That will have the possibility of damaging them and creating stones. So, again, it goes back to a life of good food, clean food, good salt, good mineral intake, good water intake, enough energy from the sun and from earthing and movement. And that should keep your body from needing to store minerals in abnormal places like kidney stones. Okay, next one. What are warts and what is their purpose? So again, if we start with what is a wart in conventional medicine, they say this is a viral infection, and so it grows and is contagious. There's A, no evidence that any wart is contagious. B, there's no evidence for any virus contained in any wart. No virus has ever been found in any wart, genital warts, or any warts on your fingers or any warts anywhere in your body. A wart is just an excretion of toxic stuff that your body doesn't want anymore and is not able to excrete it through the usual means of bowel and sweat and urine. And so it uses the accessory pathways, which is mostly the skin, to excrete probably specific kind of proteinaceous toxins, which are best excreted through the skin, and in the meantime, they form these growths as they're coming out. The growths will eventually fall off, and as long as you stop eating, abnormal food and putting other toxic stuff in your body, the warts will stop coming back. I also had an interesting experience with warts, which put them in another light. I had a friend, a roommate actually. So when I was the first year at Duke, I lived in the dorm, and then I moved out, and that was unusual. But I hated living in dorms, and I wanted to access my own food, and you couldn't do that in a dorm. So I moved out, and there was a bunch of other guys who lived there, and one guy ended up having, I don't know, 20, 30 warts all over his hands, so-called plantar warts. It was really noticeable and kind of disgusting. And then he ended up going home one weekend. He lived in South Carolina, and he came back on the weekend. So he went on Friday, went to visit his home in South Carolina, came back on Monday. And he had no warts anywhere to be seen. And we were all amazed. And of course, we asked him what happened. And he said his grandmother is a faith healer. And she put his hands, her hands over his hands and said some things, I guess, and held him there for 15, 20 minutes. And he felt sort of a tingling in his hands. And then the warts the next day just fell off and seemingly never came back. So that was a good demonstration at an early age for me of the power of the mind. And I don't know what happened, but I was 100% sure that on Friday he had all these warts and on Monday he didn't. The other interesting part of the story was he actually, it was interesting because the most attractive girl that we knew was sort of in love with this guy, but Bob, his name, wasn't interested. And none of us could understand how that could possibly be. But anyways, it turns out that Bob was gay, and turns out then he actually died of AIDS about 10 years later. And so I've often wondered whether the warts was a somehow an early sign of something not being right with him, maybe psychologically, emotionally, or toxicity or something that was sort of a early sign of something not being right. And he went on, like I said, to get AIDS and die. And that explained why he wasn't interested in that young woman. Okay. Next question, is shedding real? And we've talked about this a number of times. Shedding means that people who get a so-called COVID shot, they make something which can be passed to somebody else. And again, this is, I can't say I'm an expert on this, and there's definitely anecdotal tales of people who've been around people who've had COVID shots and then they get sick, and so they're 100% sure it's shedding. And we get a lot of questions of if your husband or wife got a COVID shot and you didn't, is it safe to have sex with them and things like that. And as far as I can tell, there's no evidence that there's anything physically being shed from one person to another. There's nothing contagious about a COVID shot. There's no spike protein that's made. There's no changed so-called genetic material that's being breathed out or passed. There's certainly no viral components. There are certainly a bunch of toxic stuff, and that's an understatement in all these shots. And it's certainly conceivable that somehow they're being sweated out or breathed out or could come out in semen or vaginal fluids. But as far as I know, there's no real clear evidence that there's any contagious component of having been vaccinated with anything, but including a COVID shot. That doesn't mean there can't be a psychological or emotional kind of contagion. And certainly I can imagine, because everybody I talk to whose spouse or intimate relationship got a shot and they didn't, that there's certainly a whole lot of conflicts in a whole lot of areas, and that could create all kind of disturbances and emotional issues and sort of barriers, et cetera, that then are expressed in certain physical ways. But as far as I know, there's no physical contagion and certainly no spike protein. As I've said many times, there's no evidence that these mRNA shots make you make any specific protein. That's not how it works. That whole central dogma of genetics has been actually disproven. Okay, final two. What about cataracts? And again, this is a sort of a challenging issue to describe, because we tend to think of these things, and for good reason, that you don't want to get cataracts. Cataracts, you can't see. And so then you have to do something about it because you can't drive at night and your life isn't as good as you'd like it to be. So how can you possibly say that is a strategy of your wise body? So the way that I would put that, so what is a cataract? A cataract is a cloudiness or a precipitation in the lens of your eye. So the lens of your eye should be a crystalline, clear, highly structured water device, so to speak. And it should be very flexible, and it should be a flexible, clear, transparent gel. And the purpose of that structure is to facilitate in some way the passage of light back into your retina, into your body, so that you can use the light in to see and probably in other creative ways. Now, the question I would ask and that I ask myself is, what if you're continually looking at abnormal forms of light? So what do I mean by that? Instead of sunlight and ambient light and natural light, you're looking at like what I'm looking at now, which is computer light, blue lights, LED lights, street lights, or even focusing too much on, say, reading and instead of just looking at the world and seeing what you see, you're actually focused on printed word and computer screens and cell phones. And so, what would I do if I was that person's body? I would somehow try to block the light because that light is not good for me. It's not healing. It's not the light that actually somehow stimulates healthy metabolism, which I think is one of the functions of light. It seems to stimulate all kinds of energetic processes in us, not only through our eyes, but through our skin and probably through our entire being. And so, if a person kept doing that, I would try to block the light in as gentle a way as possible. And that might be with the formation of cataracts. So, obviously, there's also this also can happen just like with the kidney stones. From an abnormal consumption of, say, calcium supplements or protein powders. That's another thing that I think has a lot to do with kidney stones is eating, consuming just purified, denatured protein instead of eating eggs and, grass-fed meat with the fat. The protein always has to have the fat with it. You're instead of that thinking protein is good, so I'm going to do protein powders. I would never eat a protein powder. That's not real food. That is highly processed toxic food, which I think does precipitate in our sensitive tissues, and that probably includes the kidney tubules and maybe the lens of the eye. So you don't want to do that either. But the main thing is you want to protect yourself against as much as possible against abnormal light, which means screens and LED lights, etc., as little as possible, and as much exposure to sunlight and natural light and candlelight and incandescent light and probably incandescent red lights. And those are the only lights really that we use besides a little bit of screen light that I do for my work. And that seems to be that is the way to discourage your body from having to create a strategy like forming cataracts. Now, if you get cataracts, so that's the prevention. If you get cataracts, you want to redouble your effort to not expose yourself to these toxic forms of light. And I've heard many people say that there's DMSO eye drops and DMSO plus vitamin C and DMSO plus castor oil that they will dissolve cataracts. The only thing that I've actually seen work is people rub castor oil on their eyelids, say twice a day, but once before bed, and sometimes even put a drop of castor oil into their eye before bed. And that seems to, I don't know if it actually dissolved the cataract, but it seems to help them see better and have less eye strain. And since that's really what we're looking for, that probably correlates with maybe decreased cataracts. So that's what I've done. I know there's a lot of other people who say there's this. Usually it's DMSO and vitamin C and maybe some other things. I personally haven't worked with that. I haven't seen it work, so I can't say whether that's good or even healthiest thing for you to do. And the final question is somebody asked about getting a superficial fungal infection, usually in places like your groin or your armpit, or sometimes what's called athlete's foot, so between your toes. And I still remember a guy, probably in the first few years of my practice, who he had asthma and he used inhalers, and then he started using steroid inhalers, probably not from me, but from somebody else, because he wanted to breathe better. And then one day he came in after having been in the hospital, and they had to put a tracheotomy tube into his a tube into his trachea, because he had such a bad fungal infection that it closed off his airway, and they had to bypass the blockage. And that's why he came to me. And I said, you know, what's happening here is, and he ate a lot of sugar. He liked me, but he didn't listen to anything I said, and ate a lot of sugar and took these steroids. And I explained that basically, if you eat a lot of sugar and eat processed food and crappy food and take steroids, that the fungus have to grow in order to, say, keep metabolizing the sugar so the sugar doesn't poison you. So it's basically the fungus are helping you out by getting rid of the excess sugar that would otherwise be detrimental for your health. And that's what a fungal infection is. It's not an infection. It's your body creates in a pleomorphic way, which means it turns these precursor elements called microzyma into fungus because you have too much sugar or other sort of toxins in your blood. And so the fungus will metabolize those to keep them from poisoning you, or to keep the excess sugar from poisoning you. And that's when you see so-called fungal growth either on your skin or your armpits or in your groin or between your toes. And that's what we call athlete's foot. And then you try to kill the fungus with all kinds of creams and powders, etc. But all you're doing is killing what's actually trying to help you. And so basically it never works. And the only thing that does work, and I know that when I was young and ate a lot of candy and licorice and stuff, that's when I was really young, like 13. And I had athlete's foot, which they said was contagious. And then as soon as I figured out that that was not the way to go and stopped eating sugar completely, I actually, when I was 17, I read the book called Sugar Blues, and that's sort of what got me started on this path. And so I quit eating sugar completely. And within a few months, all the so-called fungal infections cleared up. And that was the end of that. And basically never saw them again. So if you're getting superficial fungal infections, it's because the fungus are eating that which you can't metabolize. So you need to clean up your diet. And that should take care of it. There's possibly other toxins which are coming out through your skin, which the fungus are metabolizing to help you out. So you need to, like everything, look at the totality of what you're doing, living, eating, moving, sunning, earthing, etc., and get back to living a human life. And I'll finish with the quote that I just saw, which is not a quote, but a paraphrase. And I think it was from this Dr. Ulrich Williams that the Baileys are always talking about for good reason. And he said, you know, most of the disease, your body will heal as long as you stop insulting it. And that isn't exactly a quote, but it's What the problem, you don't need so much a remedy for your problem. You need to stop doing what's hurting you, what's harming you, and then your body knows how to heal. So if you stop eating sugar, your body knows how to change those fungus back into the normal microzyma, and all that will clear up. Okay. Thanks everybody for listening yet again, and it's good to if anybody has any science news or Pootski's nominations, send them our way. And I hope you have a good week, and I will see you next week.